Hey everyone, welcome to the New Insight podcast, where we interview the most important movers and shakers in ophthalmology and give you new insights on the innovations ahead. I'm your host, Viral Shah. My guests today are Drs. Roger Goldberg and David Eichenbaum. Dr. Goldberg is a vitreoretinal specialist with the Bay Area Retina Associates in Walnut Creek, California, and also faculty at CPMC Ophthalmology. Dr. Eichenbaum is a return guest to the show and a director of research for Retina Vitreous Associates of Florida and runs one of the busiest clinical trial centers in the country. I'm excited to bring to all of you today a conversation between the three of us as we start off 2024. We dive right into some of the insights from Angiogenesis 2024, one of the best scientific meetings of the year, and then we dive pretty deep into some of the recent data on therapeutics for geographic atrophy presented by both Apellis and Iveric Bio and Astellas Company. We then kind of pivot to wet AMD, where the hot topics are Genentech's Vabysmo and Regeneron's Eylea HD. And then we wrap things up with a look ahead and talk a little bit about some of the things we're excited about, such as gene therapy from companies like RegenxBio, 4DMT, Adverum, and also the return of the platform known as the Port Delivery System, and advances being made with tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or TKIs, from companies like iBio and OTX, and how those may play a role in our ever-changing therapeutic landscape. I'm thrilled to be able to give our listeners some new insights from two folks that I consider friends and clinician scientists that will continue to make a huge impact in our field. So without further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Drs. Roger Goldberg and David Eichenbaum. All right, Roger, David, thank you for joining me on the podcast here. David, welcome back. And Roger, thank you for being here for your first time. So I wanted to get you two together because, well, one, I've known you guys for a long time. And two, I think you guys have really good insights into what's happening in retina today and just good opinions in general. And so we're going to kind of dive right in just to give the listeners context. You know, we've just come off the heels of Angiogenesis 2024. A lot of hot topics were discussed, and it really kind of set the table for the year ahead. So I want to dive right in and talk about a topic that, you know, we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of the approval of Syfovre. And so, you know, GA has taken a really kind of interesting roller coaster of a year with ups and downs, a lot of buildup before the release of these treatments. And then clearly, you know, kind of some hurdles along the way. So let's talk about, you know, kind of where we are today, coming off with some recent data from Angiogenesis 2024, and maybe kind of where you are practice pattern wise with GA. So first, welcome, guys. And second, that's kind of the way we're going to start the conversation. So Roger, welcome. We can kind of start with you and see where your thoughts are at this point.
Sure. First of all, Viral, long-time listener, first-time attendee with you here. So thanks for having me on. Pleasure. And, you know, Angiogenesis, it's a long day, but it is just, you know, kind of jam-packed with great content. It's still virtual. I think by the end, your kind of virtual, ability to focus does kind of fade out a little bit. But kudos to Phil and the Bascom Palmer crew for a great meeting. And I think, you know, look, GA, I think, was one of the hot areas of this session's Angiogenesis. And I thought, you know, a couple of things. And this is a mix. The attendees at Angiogenesis, I think, are a lot like the three of us in terms of like clinically oriented translational researchers and frontline clinicians. And then there's also like a real kind of science heavy kind of component to Angiogenesis that I don't think we always see at some of our other more clinically oriented meetings. And I just felt like there was a lot more acceptance of, okay, there is this safety concern, but people are getting more comfortable with it. And I just felt like the general gestalt and the comments, and even some of the Europeans who don't have this available to them, the comments that they were making, just to me kind of conveyed a tone that says, okay, we're starting to better understand what's the risk here. I think, you know, whatever, 1 in 10,000 injections, but I think more importantly, since they all seem to happen, these vasculitis cases after the first injection, maybe somewhere between 1 in 2,500 to 1 in 4,000 risk of a first injection. event. And thankfully, that's very low. I thought Tom Albini gave a great talk, kind of comparing the different rates between Beovu and Syfovre and faricimab or Vabysmo. And, you know, we're not talking in the same league as Beovu. This is, you know, much less, almost an order of magnitude less frequent. So even Andre, who I think, you know, as always, does a great job presenting the rest committee data on the safety cases that they've received. My general thought was that people are getting a little more comfortable with it. And people are getting more comfortable with the idea that, hey, slowing GA, an anatomic benefit, you know, is probably has some associated functional benefits that didn't necessarily show up kind of in the top line outcomes, functional outcomes for these trials. But when you do all sorts of interesting secondary analyses and post hoc analyses, we actually are trying to see, and we're learning, you know, so much from these trials and from the lampalizumab trials. Like Mike Ip presented some great data on how to use microperimetry to measure functional changes in geographic atrophy. Carl Schocke presented on like kind of HD microperimetry, high definition, OCT guided microperimetry. So I think we actually will have the tools in the future to better measure a functional benefit based on what we've learned from this first generation of GA treatments that have become available. So that was generally my gestalt. David, I'm curious to hear, like, tell me you read it totally differently. I don't know.
Well, yeah, first of all, I'm happy to be here. Two of my favorite retina guys. I like Roger because he gives succinct answers. That's my favorite feature.
Absolutely.
Of speaking with Roger Goldberg. Let's see. Angiogenesis, the best, what I used to call the best 24 hours in retina. When it was live, it was a lot of fun. You would go there, you'd get up early after going to dinner the night before, hammer it out, go to dinner again, talk about it. It was cool. It's still cool. Different kind of cool now that it's on Zoom, like most of our other interactions these days, like this podcast right here, but still a packed day. GA, clearly we're moving into the next phase. Safety is tantamount to patient care. I think we all agree on that. There were a lot of presentations on that. Kudos to the rest committee and all of our friends who volunteer there, and Andre, who is the voice to the rest committee, uncompensated, lots of time, lots of data to look over, lots of emails to review, but work that's very worthwhile and very important. And Andre's presentation spoke to the fact that these very bad cases, even though they are real, are not accumulating rapidly with an increasing volume of Syfovre first injection. So that's good. Something to be aware of forever, it seems, with Syfovre, but fortunately at a very low rate. And immediately preceding angiogenesis, there was the Apellis communication about per patient rate of probably somewhere a little less frequent than the numbers that you cited, Roger. But that number is an estimate. It's tough to get a handle on, about somewhere between 2,000 and 7,000 patient incidents. Good. We're moving on to a discussion of efficacy, which is a much more engaging discussion and exciting discussion than purely a discussion of safety. And they do go hand in hand, but we are seeing competitive data, post hoc analyses, these match adjusted indirect comparisons from both Apellis and from Iveric. We're seeing real world citations in things like the Apellis press release, the 200,000 vials now used. We're getting into real world usage. We're getting into competitive data. We saw a comment from Cedric supporting a head-to-head trial during the angiogenesis conversation. He said he's 100% behind it. We'd love to see that. We're moving into a world where GA treatment is part of routine care, which is very exciting. The drugs are moderately effective. We all agree on that. But it's a huge step forward to have this as part of the daily conversation.
So you guys are both, I mean, so it sounds like you guys are both excited about, you know, treating GA, and, you know, despite the hurdles, it seems like we've kind of recovered. And David, to your point, we're starting to talk about efficacy again. So, you know, I've been in conversations with physicians that are still kind of saying, well, you know, what am I supposed to tell my patient? The vision's not getting better. You know, I'm used to a world where I'm seeing data with vision getting better, and I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around why these drugs offer value to my patients. And so, you know, how are you explaining to your colleagues who we have to kind of now kind of re-engage, right? Now that we're kind of feeling that safety is kind of back, you know, where we need it to be, or at least where you have a better understanding of the safety signals. And again, shifting back towards efficacy and this, like you said, step forward for our patients. So how are you kind of helping re-engage these clinicians, whether they're other retina specialists, your referring docs, whoever they are, what's your message to them now? Roger, go ahead. I'll start with you on that one.
Oh, I thought you were saying David. Yeah. So it's an interesting comment you made, and you're right. At the beginning of treatment of wet AMD, the vision improves or it stabilizes. And then we spend the next 5 years treating those eyes, hopefully maintaining them with a dry retina, and their vision doesn't change, or it slowly actually gets worse because underlying RPE atrophy develops. So I want to push back a little bit on the premise of your question, which is, oh, in wet AMD, like the vision gets better. Remember, like for 99% of the injections we give for wet AMD, actually the vision's kind of basically staying the same or slowly getting worse. So I think actually kind of other than that initial experience, it's not that different, I think, from a patient experience and from a clinician experience. And then I think fundamentally you have to ask yourself, like, do you believe that slowing the growth of geographic atrophy anatomically, whether you look at fundus autofluorescence and RPE cells, whether you look at photoreceptors based on spectral domain OCT, do you believe fundamentally that that is, you know, good for the patient? And I tend to believe that it is. And I think, unfortunately, you know, when Apellis and Iveric designed their clinical trials, they did so to meet the FDA approvable endpoint, which was fundus autofluorescence growth. And two, I mean, they chose ultimately, I think, kind of we look back and say, what a ridiculous, you know, functional endpoints, like microperimetry. Think about it. They had all these spots inside the atrophy. All those are zero and they stay at zero. And yet you're looking at mean sensitivity across every single point in the GA. Similarly, they had spots on microperimetry that were so far away from the GA, those aren't going to change. So, you know, like the fact that they selected mean threshold sensitivity across 68 points, you know, oftentimes more than half of which were not even like relevant or in the game at play, so to speak, you know, it's, I think, kind of like in hindsight, we can criticize it and look back and say, hey, that wasn't a great endpoint to choose. So I think we're learning more. I fundamentally believe that protecting the anatomy is important. And I think there's a lot of really good post-hoc analysis. In terms of David's point about the matched adjusted comparison studies, you know, comparing one drug to the other, I don't know if it's worthwhile. Like, should the DRCR fund a head-to-head study comparing those two? I don't think so. I think that's probably a waste of resources and a waste of GA patients who are willing to participate in clinical research. Let's go and try and develop the next generation of GA medicines rather than kind of, you know, dicker over, hey, is there like an extra 5% on this or an extra, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think the differences would probably be pretty small and I don't think it'd be worthwhile, in my humble opinion, to spend the resources to fund that head-to-head study.
Yeah, I think those are great points. David, what do you think?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Re-engaging people on GA is, I think, what you opened the narrative here about. So we're kind of going through a bit of a relaunch, not like a PDS relaunch, which we'll probably look at later this calendar year, but a bit of a relaunch compared to a year ago, because there was all this excitement, just like Roger said, there was all this excitement when we launched in March of 2023 with SYFOVRE GA. Look, we've got this huge step forward. And then we have these safety issues. And during the summer, there was something like a hard stop. And now we're kind of wondering, how do we get excitement back? Or do we get excitement back? Are these drugs exciting enough to re-engage clinicians and get the excitement back? Well, like Roger, I do fundamentally believe that we're doing our patients a service by protecting their anatomy. If you believe that photoreceptors and RPE equal vision, protecting those does equal better vision for the patients, possibly in a way that we can't demonstrate well, certainly not in a profound way. These drugs are moderately effective at best, but I do believe we're offering our patients a service to a relentlessly progressive foe, which is their GA in its native state. So that's great. How do we make people excited about that as far as their day-to-day work in the trenches with patients go? It's hard to say. I think that we need to embrace that we're doing something, embrace that there is science looking at doing something better. As Roger said, we have a robust pipeline with lots of treatments that may be less burdensome, maybe more effective, maybe restorative. We saw Alan Ho present on OpraGen, for example, which is very exciting. One of the most exciting early phase presentations of angiogenesis, along with the Annexon data and Carl Danzig's presentation of the Siglec data from Avaseta, both of which imply that we can do things with other MOAs or other targets that may be more beneficial visually. But there are patients out there that we can treat now with the hope of saving some of their anatomy to treat later with another drug that's better. And that's a narrative that I do employ with patients and employ with doctors when there's a lot of negativity about the current commercially available drugs. The exciting things are yet to come. You know, in addition to understanding and fully kind of grokking what we've got now, we've got a lot of things in the hopper, most of which, of course, aren't going to work as well as we want them to in the end. But if one or two of them really do, we've got a next generation. And I think we need to, as a community, be able to wrap our heads around this generation of benefit, as well as the risks with this generation, to move forward to that which is to come.
So again, great ways of describing kind of where we're at. I think a year from now, we'll probably have, you know, even more robust discussion. Maybe at that point, you know, we will kind of see where people are leaning, you know, one versus the other in terms of treatment, or if we just kind of have two camps, right? There's the Syfovre camp and the Izervay camp, right? So I think it'll be interesting to see how this next year unfolds. Hopefully kind of safety continues to be, you know, above where we need it to be. And efficacy, I think we're going to see play out in the real world. Real world data, I'm sure, will be coming out at some point. And so I think a lot more information to come. But so along the same lines of this kind of, you know, head-to-head conversation, the other kind of head-to-head topic that came up in the second half of the meeting this past week was the Vabysmo versus Eylea HD discussion, right? And there was a lot of conversation about that. Obviously, a different topic altogether because, you know, wet AMD and our treatments for that is a much more mature space. We've had two decades of experience there. And we've got two really good treatments that are out now, right, between Vabysmo and Eylea HD. So we had a lot of kind of year two data being presented for Eylea HD. We had a lot of kind of new sub-analyses for Vabysmo. So where are you guys at with that now, knowing that Vabysmo has been out for a little longer, so you've had more experience, more time with that. Eylea HD is still working on getting their permanent J code, so there's a little bit of kind of an uptake still that has to happen there. So where are you guys in your clinical practice in terms of your comfort? Do you feel like you've kind of one has an edge over the other? Are you still kind of waiting to see that? Well, we'll start with David this time.
Sure. Thanks. So I do like both of these drugs. These are both drugs that I've been involved with as a clinical trialist in phase 2 and 3 for faricimab. In phase 3, we were the largest site in the Pulsar study for wet AMD, and we enrolled robustly for Photon, for DME as well. So lots of preclinical experience with these drugs. And because of that, my practice, I think, was on the more leading edge of the adoption curve for both faricimab, branded as Vabysmo, and for 8 milligram aflibercept, Eylea HD. We have had, of course, as you stated correctly, much less experience with Eylea HD because it's been only approved for a couple of months, and we do not have robust access to it across all commercial and Medicare Advantage payers. But we've been injecting a lot of it in our original Medicare patients. Both of these drugs are really good drugs. I think both of them are better than the preceding gold standard, which is Eylea 2 milligram. I think there is superiority in drying and superiority in durability. I don't think there's any superiority in vision, but we're not looking for vision with these drugs. We've never really looked for vision. I think faricimab was looking for vision for a little while, and that was abandoned when there was clearly no visual superiority. But durability is a real attainable goal with both of these drugs. What's really interesting is they both have the same bottom line story. They both say we'll get you out to 16 weeks or longer, but with a different top line. You know, Eylea is more of what you love, and faricimab is, look, we're doing something different. And I think that the faricimab secondary analyses are compelling and they're really cool. We've had more time with them. We're going to see secondary analyses for Eylea HD, which may tell a similar story. And frankly, you know, I can't tell if one drug is better than another. I think in some patients, one drug will be better than the other. Some patients might be really driven more by Ang2. Some patients may really respond to the type of inhibition and blockade that Eylea offers and that more Eylea would offer more of. And I think we're kind of going to have to figure it out. And there's going to be switcher studies, of course, and there's going to be a lot of clinical experience to lean on. But from the data that we have in the clinical trials, I don't think we can call one of these drugs better than the other, but we can call both of them superior to Eylea 2 milligrams.
Okay, good. Roger, what do you think?
Yeah, first of all, I agree with David's bottom line statement, which is I do think both of these are better. And I think ultimately the market is going to migrate to HD and Vabysmo. And I think 2 milligram will kind of, you know, linger with some toehold in part because biosimilars of it will be coming to the market. And hopefully that kind of generation one drugs will drop in cost. I think Avastin will always maintain some little market share amongst our, you know, bad payers or due to step therapy and other insurance requirements. But I agree with David. I think both drugs are a step forward and an improvement over what we have. I will say this, and I feel fortunate. I've just presented at Hawaiian Eye a couple weeks ago some really compelling data looking at the most difficult to treat DME eyes from Photon, the eyes with the most swelling on average. You know, they had to have over 512 to be in this fourth quartile or most swollen retinas. On average, I think they started off like somewhere between 610 and 630 microns of CST. So very thick, very swollen retinas. And I think that data is actually the most compelling data where we looked kind of after the loading dose, what happens kind of 4 and 8 weeks after either a 2 milligram or an 8 milligram loading dose. And in the 8 milligram arm, kind of 8 weeks after, the fluid is basically stable to where you were at the end of your loading phase. Whereas 8 weeks after 2 milligram Eylea after the loading phase, it was actually 50 microns worse. It had backslid quite a lot. Yeah. And so to me, I think that really points to the durability of 8 milligram Eylea versus 2 milligram Eylea. And then actually both David and I have presented the macular leakage story for Vabysmo, which shows a marked improvement in macular leakage in diabetic macular edema in DME patients looking at fluorescein angiography. Now I know most of us aren't sitting there kind of measuring out the amount of macular leakage in our DME patients. And so I think that's actually the most compelling data to support Ang2's role in at least many of these DME eyes, or at least DME eyes with a lot of macular leakage, and Ang2 kind of versus just upping the amount of VEGF inhibition can actually play a role in stabilizing those blood vessels. So I do think we've got really compelling data. I will say this, and I actually think it kind of touches back on something we didn't mention with the Syfovre versus Izervay debate, which is Syfovre did two large clinical trials, phase three trials, and Izervay did kind of one smaller one, Gather One, which is a phase 2/3, but counted as a pivotal and a phase three, but both much smaller than Oaks and Derby for Syfovre. Similarly, in AMD, Genentech, you know, ponied up for two large trials, Yosemite and
Tenaya and Lucerne, yeah.
Tenaya and Lucerne, thank you. Yeah, versus just Photon, yeah. Versus just Pulsar.
Pulsar, yeah.
One study, and in DME they did two studies, 1,800 patients versus the one study Photon. And so what does having these much larger data sets allow you to do, whether you're Apellis or you're Genentech? It allows you to mine that data for so much more interesting insights and learnings. So I think that Syfovre or Apellis and Genentech will have a data advantage in what they're able to show the community, all of us, over the next, let's say, 5 years, as we continue to mine these clinical trials for deep insights about, you know, and how we can better handle our patients. So I do think kind of like just the magnitude of the data will provide some, at least let's call it podium advantage for those two companies.
Yeah. No, it's a great point. I mean, even the epiretinal membrane conversation, the PEDs, I mean, there's so many things that are coming out now. And I think you're right. It's because of the robust data set that they can pull this information out, and we'll see, you know, what comes out of the Regeneron data. I'm sure they'll find something too, but it's a matter of kind of, you know, how robust that data is. So I think those are great points.
And as a matter of scale, it's important to remember that the HD trials were not at nearly as small as the Izervay trials. They were still several hundred patients dosed with IP versus, you know, Gather 1, which is a pretty small trial, and Gather 2, which was 220 or so patients dosed with IP, definitely large enough for the FDA and large enough to be considered a pivotal, not nearly as large as the faricimab program, which is the largest DME program we've ever seen in our field. But I think you're right, Roger. I think that the kind of competitive data rollout does favor the companies that have the data to make more competitive arguments with. And I think what's really interesting and what we're going to see much more of sort of in this round with the GA drugs and the second generation anti-angiogenic and bispecific drugs is we're going to see a lot more reliance on real world data, partly because we can get it really quickly compared to when Eylea 2 mg and Lucentis came out, when the world was still significantly paper-based. Now we have Far Wide and Far Retina, for example, already pushing out real-world data. Before that, we had Truckee, which was limited in its scope, but still we had real-world data coming out almost immediately after Vabysmo was released, and now we have large real-world data sets only 2 years after Vabysmo was released. I'm sure we'll see the same with Eylea. And why do we like real-world data? Real-world data is uncontrolled, sloppy, full of confounders. Who knows what's going on with this population of patients? Well, we like it because of what Roger alluded to. We like it because it's huge. I mean, we're Americans. We like things huge. And we like huge data sets. You know, huge data sets, you can do certain things with, and you can do the data mining that you can't do with small data sets. So I think that might be a place where we make up for some of the relative paucity of data and things like the Gather 1 and 2 series and the relatively small size of the Pulsar and Photon trials.
Yep, absolutely.
So okay, who's going to be the Arshad to spearhead real world Eylea HD? Sorry, Viral, I know you're
I'll let you guys rock paper scissors for that one.
Who's going to? No, I'm asking the two of you. I don't know. Like you know, Arshad.
I don't know. I'm sure there will be
Julian you know, energy to do all these things. And he really spearheaded that, frankly, single-handedly, at least at the beginning.
And it's a huge effort. And so, you know, to David's point, I think there are ways that we can generate that data that are going to be a little less labor intensive, right? I mean, if you're just purely mining the data and setting your parameters ahead of time. So I think there's going to be huge data sets that come out. I know large retina practices and multi-specialty groups are starting to dive into that already. And I wouldn't be surprised if a year from now we have giant data sets that are being presented at these meetings. But yeah, I think we can do these in less labor intensive ways. And I think we're going to be better for it with all that information out there. So, all right. So we did the GA topic. We did the wet AMD kind of, you know, fight that's starting to happen now. And we'll see a year from now where that ends up. So what are the other kind of, if you're looking forward now, you know, to 2024, we're just at the beginning of meeting season. There's tons of meetings ahead. And I think a lot of those topics were teased at Angiogenesis, whether it's, you know, data coming up on TKIs, maybe some gene therapy updates that we're going to get. What are you guys looking forward to? And it could be those, you know, programs that are a little further along and more mature, or it could be stuff, David, like you were mentioning, that's still pretty early phase. What are you excited about and what are you looking forward to this year to see in terms of data?
Well, what's back, baby? Well, intravitreal gene therapy is back, baby, after angiogenesis. Yeah. We saw data from 4DMT, which is super compelling, at least where it's at. It's at week 24. There are steroids on board through week 20, so we can't have a party yet about intraocular inflammation. But it was super encouraging. Nice to see after we were all disappointed with the DME patients from Adverum who had significant intraocular inflammation. And look at Adverum, look at Ixo-vec. We have the low dose of Ixo-vec in wet AMD with promising intravitreal gene therapy results. You know, intravitreal delivery is still the aspiration. It's clearly got risks with IOI because of, I think, the tissue that is transfected and the dose volume compared to subretinal delivery, for example, but it's the preferred delivery method. So we got to see how the intravitreal gene therapy story unfolds through the rest of 2022. Looking at the timelines, we should see by the end of the year, the one-year results of the 4D patients when they've fully gone off their corticosteroid taper to see if we have a happy ending or a so-so ending to their IOI story, which was the most exciting, I think, phase two data from angiogenesis this past weekend.
I agree. Look, I think 4DMT's data, I think, was, you know, promising, but I think for gene therapy, the bar is really, for me personally, 2-year data. Because if, let's say, by 1 year out, the proportion of patients needing rescue or more frequent rescue really starts to diminish, I sit there and scratch my head and saying, well, why am I doing gene therapy versus, you know, the eye point or, you know, a 6-month TKI? And I can inject that and I can do a rescue with a, you know, Vabysmo or an Eylea HD in the intervening 3 months. So to me, the promise of gene therapy is truly one and done. So to me, I need to see kind of basically we plateau and the number of patients who are injection free basically remain injection free. And to my mind, the bar is 2 years. 2-year data is what I'd like to say.
The more I'm learning about gene therapy, the less I think we're looking at one and done. I think we're looking at one and less. And I 100% agree that the competitor for gene therapy is the TKIs. And the dark horse versus gene therapy is the port delivery system, which is coming back at some point, probably in the second quarter, because we know a lot about that technology. We know a lot about the safety profile. We all consider ourselves, most of us consider ourselves surgical. So, you know, that has its limitations as a mechanical device, but it has kind of a mature data set. But the one and done, I think, is not something I'm looking for anymore for any gene therapy. I'm looking for one and less. And I guess the $1 billion question is how much less is one and less? And if I can also get that one and less with EYP-1901 or OTX's TKI or perhaps other TKIs that are in phase one, why go through the complexities of a gene therapy? So we have to see. We have to see. But I'm not expecting one and done. I don't ascribe personally a huge high value to one and done. But one and something significantly less is what I do need out of a gene therapy.
So David, you mentioned PDS. Let's take a second on that. You know, you said you're excited. Maybe that it's coming back. You know, limited maybe usage in the beginning. Are you excited about that being more of a platform than an actual drug? I mean, if you talk about, you know, all these evolutions, we talked about different MOAs being able to potentially leverage that to inject other MOAs that are going to be more durable. Is that something you're thinking about or how are you looking at it?
Oh, hugely, hugely. We already know that we can mitigate some of the surgical problems. We hope we can mitigate the durability problem, the septum issue. We have data that Dante showed at angiogenesis, which well, many of us will be working with throughout the year at the revised needle, which is the revised needle is not the huge leap forward. It's potentially the change in the overmold and the septum. That's the huge leap forward. So between those two things, the less force required for refill and then the improved durability of the refill contact patch, so to speak, we're hopefully going to be able to mitigate that. And I certainly think if we can get something that's bispecific in there, if we can get something that works for geographic atrophy in there and mirror the safety that we've seen in Ladder and Portal and Archway, you're talking about something that might really have some legs. And you can turn it off, unlike gene therapies. You know, you can just stop filling it. And that might be very, very important in some patients, or as we learn more about the most common unusual adverse event of subretinal gene therapy, which are these pigmentary changes. Currently, that doesn't seem to be a deal breaker, but we got to learn more about it. So there is some theoretic advantage to PDS. It lacks sort of the foreign bodyless elegance of a subretinal or intravitreal or suprachoroidal gene therapy, but it does have a lot of controllability, which of course you lose when you start transfecting things. So I do think that as a platform, we have a lot of potential there yet. Again, if we can get the community over the black box and over the disappointment with the durability and things that the community kind of has to be able to move forward with. It goes back to our earlier conversation. We got to get the retina specialists excited about new things and into a conversation about tolerance of risk and benefit.
Roger, any comments on that? I know you've had some time to work with PDS as well. So what are your comments on that?
Yeah, and I was in Archway, and we implanted it during the clinical trial. I did not have any commercial experience with it. And it's interesting. I think, surgery just always introduces an element of uncertainty, and retina docs don't like uncertainty. And I don't think anybody likes uncertainty, not just us retinal docs. So like Jared Nielsen published a pictorial article in Ophthalmology Retina this month. I don't know if you guys saw it, showing a patient with like robust fibrosis over the port delivery mm-hmm. system. And then he had like a anterior segment OCT. So you could kind of see it in cross-section, beautiful images. And then he had like another patient where it was like kind of the more normal or typical appearance. And I'll tell you, even with that new refill or even with like a better cemented in septum, I think that's going to be a really tough port to refill. And so I think we haven't totally cracked the code on the port delivery system. I agree Genentech is very kind of heavily invested in it and excited. And so if anybody's going to put the resources behind it to A, figure out, you know, how do we minimize uncertainty? You know, look what the glaucoma specialist did. They said, hey, what if we put like a little mitomycin down for, you know, a few seconds? Can we get rid of like overlying fibrosis? Or, you know, I don't know what the answer is going to be there, but I know like, hey, you wouldn't want that for a patient you've just put, you know, through the rigor of surgery, you know, to then have them develop fibrosis overlying the septum where you need to do the refill exchange. So like David said, I am more excited, frankly, about like a Dutafab, which is a bispecific approach, or a GA therapy, kind of bringing in our next generation of medicines into that. So I'm excited about it as a platform technology, mostly.
Yeah. And to your point, I mean, they're a company that will put the resources behind it. I mean, like you said, they're already running the Dutafab trial, and I'm sure hopefully GA will be, you know, shortly behind that as well. So, I think we've covered a lot of topics. I think it's been a great conversation. I'm going to, you know, for the sake of time, we'll do round two at some point, and with lots of meetings on the way.
You mean Roger's going to be invited back? Roger, you didn't screw up. You're going to get to come back.
Yeah. We got to dive into Roger's kind of story a little bit more too. So we'll take some time to do that at some point. But I want to thank both of you guys for your time and the insights. I think people, it's good for people to hear about this, because these meetings can be somewhat kind of, you know, narrow and esoteric, and it's good to get this information out to the public, because it's going to impact, you know, what happens on Saturday at these meetings is going to impact what we do on Monday in the clinic. And so hopefully when we kind of see this play out, the rest of the meetings, the data and everything, we're kind of continuing to move in the right direction. Thank you guys. I appreciate it. Roger, thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. David, we'll have you back on too, David. Don't worry.
I made it. Phew. I also made the cut. Vero, yeah. Roger, lots of fun, guys. Always fun to talk with you. Let's have a beer next time.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Yeah. Thank you for listening in to the New Insight Podcast. We really appreciate your time. Be sure to subscribe to our channel on your preferred listening or watching platform. And if you're interested in more ophthalmology news or other podcasts, visit hcplive.com and check out our offerings. For now, I'm Dr. Viral Sheth. Hope to see you next time to discuss what's new in sight.